This is Twit.
All right, Steve, you have a picture?
So our picture of the week, yes.
Yes.
Wow. It's more what I was expecting when I said last week that the consequence of being forced to flush the page lookup tables to me was mind-boggling. You know, I'm old school, and I don't really believe any of this works. That can't get off the ground. So, you know, the idea is, as I was explaining last week, the virtual memory mapper in Intel architectures is this three-level lookup table where the address that you're fetching isn't the actual physical address at all. It's an index into a table, which is an index into a table, which is an index into a table. And you need all of those in order to figure out what the value is. And you do cache the result, and those tables are cached. And that's what's called the TLB, the translation look-aside buffer, because there's this notion in general in computing that something you've done recently, you are more likely to do again than not. And the classic example is looping. If you are looping over some code, that means you go back to the top and you do it again with different values or for, you know, different inputs or something. But so that says that, oh, look, I'm rerunning instructions that I recently ran. So this is why the whole concept of caching makes sense. We have dynamic memory, the main motherboard, you know, the whatever it is, 4, 8, 16 gigabytes of main RAM. Due to the technology, it fell behind a long time ago in keeping up with our processors. They just, no one has been able to make main memory go fast. Now, we've talked about little interesting ideas. There's some cross-wire technology that HP's kind of trying to get off the ground. Intel has it too, cross-point. So maybe we'll see something dramatic happen. But so far, main memory is compared to the way our processors have just leaped ahead in speed, it's the laggard. So it's necessary to use this notion of reusing something or hoping that you're going to be able to reuse something you recently slowly fetched from main memory again. So all of these modern chips have on-chip caches. And you mentioned L1, L2, L3. They're in a hierarchy. The ones closest to the chip are the fastest and the smallest. And then there's a next level further back, and then a third level, and they each get larger and sometimes slower, but also it's more of a function of access patterns. When you've got multiple cores, now you've got different processor cores all competing with each other for sharing this common pool of cache, all which is trying to provide, like, just arrange to feed these hungry chips data as quickly as they need it. So also shared are these virtual memory lookup tables. And so what I was saying last week was, you know, the idea that crossing from the user land, user code, to the kernel would require the flushing of that incredibly valuable, because it's so slow to get it to load it, the idea that it would force the flushing of that cache was just like, you know, as I said, I don't really believe any of this works to start with. I've sort of reluctantly agreed that, okay, Wi-Fi seems to be working somehow at ridiculous speeds, you know, and when modems started going to 56K, it's like, what? No, modems go at 300 baud or maybe 12, but, you know, not 56K, but yeah, they somehow did. So this picture demonstrates what happened on one of three of Epic games servers when they installed the Meltdown mitigation. And this is much more in keeping with what I expected. So you can't see it, but there are three chart lines. There's green, orange, and blue, as there's a little index down in the lower left, a little key showing them. And so, and what you see is this sine wave, which anyone who's run a big server is familiar with. That's the diurnal cycle of CPU being busy. You notice it hits a nadir. They're all kind of lowest around 4 a.m. And I'm not sure if this is, you know, UTC or what time zone, but then it also peaks pretty much on the opposite side of the day. And so that's just sort of generally people are sleeping and then they're waking up and doing stuff. Well, that sudden jump is one of the three processors, the green trace, where Meltdown mitigation was applied. And it's about 2.5 times. If you look at the low point there of all the traces, just before 4 a.m., you can see that it crosses right around 10%. And now if you look up at the green line, it's more than 25%. It's maybe about 27%, whereas the other guys are at 10. So for their use case, the Meltdown mitigation jumped their processor's utilization, CPU utilization, by about 2.7, which I believe, based on the severity of the need to discard this slow-to-acquire cache data every time you switch between the kernel and the user. So this is the kind of picture that is what I was expecting, rather than this, you know, we've heard, 1% or point something or maybe 5. I was like, okay, you know, again, it is completely a function of what you're doing. We've talked
how much kernel mode access you need compared to how much user mode.
Well, actually, it's how much crossing. It's the boundary crossing.
Right. So if you go into the kernel and you read, and then you exit there, the kernel.
Right.
Then there's that one swap then. But if you go back and forth, that's when you're going to get the biggest hit, right? Because you don't want user mode to have access to kernel mode information. So you flush the cache. You go into user mode, and then you go back to kernel mode. Do they flush it twice? Do they flush it when you go back into the kernel mode? No, you wouldn't need to then.
Correct. You don't need to flush it when you go from the kernel. I mean, when you go from the user to the kernel, because we trust the kernel.
Right.
There's no malware there. It's user code looking at the residual from being in the kernel. And so it's when you switch to the user that the kernel needs to remove its what I described last week as footprints, you know, because essentially. And this comes back to that statement I made. In any setting where and caching is a perfect example. It's not speculation. We'll talk about that in a second. But in any setting where short-term performance optimizations have global effect, a sufficiently clever task can infer the recent history of other tasks by observing its own performance. In other words, so caching is a short-term performance optimization. And if the cache is global, that is, if everybody gets the benefit of it, then clever tasks can figure out what's in the cache and what isn't by making a fetch and observing how long it takes, observing its own performance. And so the 20,000 view, the 20,000 foot view here is that. The way we've been cruising for the last several decades is we've been creating faster performance by creating processors that are increasingly clever about optimizing what they expect to have happen next, but that expectation, whether it's cash or whether it's specular architecture that we'll be talking about, speculation, that inherently allows these kinds of problems. And so that's why this is, as I said before, this is industry shaking. I mean, this has always been sitting there. Nobody really worried about it until now. Everybody's worrying about it. So,
and we don't know really who knew about it and when. I mean, we learned about it now, but who knows? Although, it feels like this is, and this is the other thing I've been speculating on. And I can't remember if it was Bruce Schneier or Brian Krebs talked about the synchronicity, the fact that two different teams simultaneously discovered this. I would guess security researchers kind of run down similar avenues.
Four teams. Well, if you broaden the window a little bit, within a couple of months, and that was Bruce talking about this.
Bruce, okay.
And there is, you know, there is a security community. There's conferences. There's papers being published. Everybody's reading everything.
Right.
And so it's not like there's been no cross-pollination at all. So it may have been, for example, that last summer somebody did something, or, you know, like cash timing is that's now a thing.
Well, and Roehammer, maybe something like
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Yeah, so there's sort of there is something kind of in the air where individual researchers will, you know, kind of think, I'm going to spend some time thinking about this, you know, and because they're often researching in a silo within their own group or their own team or their own university or their own corporation, you know, they're wanting to produce results that are, you know, proprietary until they're publicly disclosed, especially if it's something like this where they have to, you know, whisper what they found to the parties who are affected, they're not going to be talking about it. So it is interesting, but not surprising that suddenly this just kind of all happened. It was probably set up by, you know, again, just sort of what was in the air in the last few years and eventually bound to happen.